Mortgage capital markets decisions carry real financial consequences. That's why Optimal Blue commissioned an independent ROI study with MarketWise advisors, analyzing results across hundreds of lenders. The study highlights consistent gains in efficiency, accuracy, and financial performance, including an average $1,006 net benefit per loan. To be notified when the full 2026 Optimal Blue ROI study is released in May, sign up at optimalblue.com/2026-study.
Welcome to Optimal Insights, your weekly source for real-time rate data and expert capital markets commentary, brought to you by Optimal Blue. Let's dive in and help you maximize your profitability this week.
Welcome to Optimal Insights. I'm your host, Jim Glennon, Senior Vice President of Hedging and Trading Operations at Optimal Blue. Our clients and industry partners have long relied on Optimal Blue for trusted insights and commentary, and these podcasts are an evolution of our commitment to keeping the industry informed. Let's dive into today's episode. Welcome, everybody. Thank you for being here. Getting into the end of January already, which is kind of crazy to think about. We got a great show for you today. Glad you tuned in. We're going to have a market update here in a little bit. Tons to talk about there as we get into the middle of Q1. We have a special guest today. Mike Vogue and I will interview Julie May. Julie is the Vice President and General Manager of B2B Scores at FICO. So she'll be joining us for a timely conversation about the state and the future of credit reporting, which is obviously a huge pillar of the mortgage process. So we'll talk to her here in a sec. Before we get into anything else, just in the way of data, continuing to see that spread, the spread between treasuries and mortgages shrink, decrease. We've got the 10-year is still around 4.25%. It's been in that range for a really long period of time. And if that's the only measurement you watch in terms of interest rates, you might think rates haven't moved very much. But meanwhile, the OBMMI is at 6.1. We had been hovering more around 6.25% earlier in January and going back to into December. But some of the news about the $200 billion that the GSEs are poised to buy, in addition to some other things going on around efforts to reduce that spread, really efforts, from the administration to get creative about how to make mortgages more affordable. We've seen some shrinkage in that spread. So that's a welcome development. Again, 6.1 on the OBMMI and seeing really good volume continue through January, mostly because of that. Just more refi business, obviously. So let's get into a market update here.
Good morning, everybody. You got Alex and James here running the economic update this week. Jim is out of the office on this beautiful Monday, January 26th morning. So we are coming at you with just the two of us today. Just kind of off the top and where we are with rates. Just kick things off. OBMI kind of tough to crack as our rates across the market, OBMI trading at 6.088%, that being the average rate lock that we're seeing in the Optimal Blue system, and the 10-year, tough to crack as well, trading at north of 4.2% as of this morning and was as high as 4.3% in the last week, which I think is just on the back of the geopolitics that we were talking about last week. Right, James?
Yeah, so it definitely seems post-Davos some cooler heads have prevailed here for now, at least. But the market definitely bounced back after the speech at Davos saying, hey, we're not really looking to do military intervention. We're going to figure this out with diplomacy. That really settled people down. The market came back, cooled off a lot. So always good when, we're talking peace times. It's definitely geopolitics, the world, that's been a little crazy. And so any cool down is something that we're definitely happy to see. Speaking of cooling down, it looks like we got PCE this week or this past week. The number is still stuck at about 2.8, but our more general inflation numbers have crept down a little bit. So something just to watch in the future. PCE is, of course, the Fed's preferred gauge. So looking at what they want to see, what they are judging, how inflation is working, it is still stuck a bit higher than they want.
Absolutely. We've been in this place, it feels like, for at least 6 months now. with whether it's PCE or CPI, it's been trading right around 2.7, 2.8% on every release. And that is going to keep the inflationary pressure there, in my opinion. We've continued to cut rates into the face of that. And I think we're a long ways from the days of pre-COVID and a 2% targeted inflation rate. So this continues to, I would say, kind of be backburnered as an issue. Much more so, people are just focusing on the general health of the day-to-day economy and jobs, you know, the Fed's other mandate, keeping us at full employment.
Yeah, and that initial jobless claim last week came in a bit better than expected, 200K. Jobs seem to be trending fine enough. Inflation is a little too high, but fine enough. We have, exactly as you said, we're kind of stuck in this holding pattern. There is a Fed meeting, FOMC meeting this week on Wednesday. It is highly unexpected that there would be any sort of rate cut with just the data that's coming out, as well as the general fight that is going on around the Fed might be pushing some people to hold off further. I think I saw the CME was projecting 98% chance of no rate cut this time around, 2% chance that we actually would. I don't think Mirren is going to pull them down over the next 48 hours, but, you know, stranger things.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm with you there. And I'm with the market on this one. We're caught in the middle, you know. Inflation keeps things just hot enough to keep rates where they're at, and the jobs market isn't melting down by any means. As we've always said, the weekly jobless claims of 250 or more is kind of the hot spot for that, and that's when we'd start to see them really begin to push for lower rates. Also, the politics around the Fed right now, I'm in agreement there as well that some of the older heads on the Federal Reserve Board are likely, I think, in the face of the Trump administration's pressures on the Fed to maybe pump the brakes on rate cuts, which has been a very out push from the Trump administration.
Speaking on kind of that line, so Mirren, who had originally replaced Kugler, technically that term is coming due. We were trying to look this up before the cast here, but there's no real news so far on who might be replacing Mirren. I think both you and I are leaning they will probably reinstate Mirren for the longer term. Although Mirren has said that he preferred the work that he was doing over at the White House on the Economic Council. So there could be a shifting of the guard there, but seems likely that he'll be sticking it through just based on the lack of news.
Yeah, I'm in agreement there. I was hoping to see a headline that we'd get some either official confirmation that Mirren will be continuing in that role, or if Trump will be nominating somebody else. But I don't think it really matters who's in that role. I mean, at the end of the day, it's either going to be Mirren or someone else that Trump is nominating. And we know where his thoughts
are. His head will be at.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. So whether it's Mirren or somebody else, they will be pushing for probably double rate cuts for the foreseeable future. Just some general market analysis. You know, we've also just want to, you know, point out that, you know, precious metals have been on quite a run. You know, we kind of kicked the top of this segment off talking about some of the fears that remain in the rates market. And I think that's been reflected into the precious metals market. Just to note, you know, silver hit $100 an ounce on Friday, gold hit $5,000 an ounce today, the day of this recording, and they've just been on massive, massive runs, which, you know, I'm not a gold bug by any means, but it's just something to keep in mind that it's a reflection of the fears in the market right now in regards to perception of stability of the U.S. government, the U.S. dollar, U.S. markets in general. Anytime there's a flare up in global tensions, we see the Capital Route articles all over. I think those articles are a little bit overblown, but it does kind of showcase where some heads are in the market. On the flip side of that, you know, I was reading some B of A research this morning. Domestic fund managers remain extremely bullish. They've got kind of record low sideline cash right around 3% right now. So just things to keep an eye on in regards to how, you know, institutional investors who are the ones moving the market most days of the week are viewing things at this juncture. And just to round out this coming week, we'll get a second final inflation reading for the month. That'll be PPI this Friday. It's expected in the same neighborhood as our CPI and PCE readings at 2.8%. I think that covers us pretty well on the news and different data releases that have been occurring or are coming down the pipeline here. James, I know you and I, we want to discuss one option in regards to mortgage affordability in the mortgage market here that's been gaining a little bit of traction and it's seeing some research analysis.
Definitely. So you and I were both reading a paper from MSCI this morning that was just talking about mortgage affordability. So, you know, the administration has done a big push the past month on affordability. So there was the 50-year mortgage. There was, they might be locking Wall Street out of purchasing houses, which certain areas that could really have an effect in. Now they're looking at mortgage portability. So the idea being, I like easy numbers. If I was one of the lucky people who got, you know, those 2% rates during COVID on a $500,000 house, and now I've got, you know, wife, two kids, I'm kind of looking to move out of that starter house, I would be able to look at a larger property, let's say $600,000, and I could move my mortgage from the starter house to that larger one. I think of it a little bit as tranching almost. So my $500,000 mortgage would move with me. I would continue paying at my 2% rate, and then I would take another $100,000 to cover that last spread there, and it would be at the current market rate. So this way, I would be able to continue paying majority of my low rate, but actually afford to move in to that larger house. This is something that's been, people have been kicking the tires on for a while. It actually, you know, when we were looking into it, it does turn out a lot of countries in Europe, this is a very normal mortgage portability is already allowed. So America is a little behind the ball on that one. I think we were both in agreement that this is it's a good idea. It makes sense. There's definitely people who are going to benefit from this, but it does mean people will be trading houses a little bit more quickly, which is going to encourage price appreciation, right? If there's more demand, right? At the end of the day, the underlying problem is still supply, and that's the hardest issue to address. But the more tools that you can use to try and get into a house, the better.
Absolutely. I am in agreement that this is one of the better options that have been put forward. And I definitely think that there are certain demographics that this will be helping most. I think you kind of point out maybe an elder millennial type, you know, maybe like moving into a larger home. I could also see it benefiting maybe some empty nesters on the other side. Maybe they wouldn't even be taking an additional loan. They're just going to look to port over, you know, from their larger family home into something smaller as they, you know, as the kids leave the house, whatever it may be. You know, I think it could help both of those demographics. And like you said, that'll open up new homes to those that might be looking and just increase the amount of transactions that we're seeing in the industry. This MSCI paper, what they were talking about is obviously this is attractive to borrowers. You know, someone that wants to hold on to their 2%, that's been a major barrier for them to move in the last 4 or 5 years. So if they're able to move that, it makes a lot of sense for them, you know. But how do you make this attractive to investors? And MSCI was pointing out that there's likely going to be a fee incurred based on the difference between current market rate and the rate that is being ported. That'll make this more attractive for investors as well. Kind of the third stakeholder in our industry being servicers. This one's quite attractive to them, I would think, just given that a loan that would otherwise be paid off and the servicing on that lost will be ported over if that option is exercised.
Yeah, definitely. And so, you know, Alex works over on the pipeline side of Optimal Blue, and I work over on the MSR side. So it is interesting to see that this kind of works out well for the purchaser. So exactly as you're saying, hey, if you're porting this over, you're continuing to pay that 3% rate. So whatever pool that your loan ended up slotted into and sold, you're not, you know, normally you would take a new mortgage, pay off the old one, it would prepay entirely. So this is going to change how prepayment speeds work. This is going to change how attractive an MBS pool is. This is going to change just the entire profile in there. So it's definitely interesting, and effectively it could change it for the better. And so that means, you know, a better priced pool, you're getting your money back quicker, you're able to lend more efficiently. And so, yeah, and that might help bring rates down and then get more buyers into the market. So this is it's definitely a good tool.
Well, perfect. I'm definitely going to be keeping an eye on portable loans and any more white papers that might be coming out, just because I think this is one of the best ideas that we've seen put forth on the affordability front so far. With all that being said, we hope everyone stays warm in these coming days. We know that most of the snow and ice across the country has departed, but I know there's still quite a bit of cleanup work to do. So wishing everyone the best. Thanks for joining me today, James.
No, thank you.
All right. Mike and I are here with Julie May, Vice President and General Manager of B2B Scores at FICO. Julie is responsible for global product and business development, delivery, and support for the FICO score. Excited to have Julie here today. Julie's been with FICO, I believe, for over 20 years. And over the course of her career, she's held senior roles in every aspect of delivering tech, analytics, and other solutions. And her expertise spans enterprise software, advanced analytics, fraud management, cybersecurity, and more. And somehow Julie still finds time to pen a blog, which you should check out. Lots of timely updates there about credit reporting, just the industry, and some of what we'll talk about today. So I'm sure I missed a few things here, but safe to say that Julie is an industry guru, and we're happy to have her here today. Welcome, Julie.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
And you're in Texas, right?
I am in Texas. Yeah, I spend part of my time in Texas and part of my time in Nashville. So kind of back and forth between those two areas. But today I'm in Texas waiting for some impending ice and snow. So
I was gonna ask you if you're staying warm. Yeah, we have a lot of teammates in Texas, and they're in the middle of it right now. It sounds like we're on the way to some.
There was no bread left yesterday in the grocery store. So, you know. Was not very good.
Of course. Yeah, we're at like 7 degrees here in Denver, and it's business as usual. But Texas, yeah. you can't get below freezing without freaking people out.
Exactly.
Right on. Well, again, thanks for being here. We've got some questions to kind of kick off the conversation and get us talking about credit reporting and the FICO score and some of the changes that are going on with competition in the industry. You know, before we get into more recent events, though. Could you stage a bit for our listeners? Can you explain what FICO does, what their role is in the mortgage industry, especially including tri-merge and the potential for a bi-merge?
Yeah. So, FICO is the only kind of independent standard credit score provider out there. And so we invented credit scoring, really, right? So FICO stands for Fair Isaac Corporation, for those who don't know that. A little bit of background, we were founded by two Stanford grads, Bill Fair and Earl Isaac, in a long, long time ago in 1956. And they decided that they could find a better way to take something that wasn't systematic and make it systematic, and that was credit scoring. Interestingly, they sent out letters to literally hundreds of lenders, and almost nobody replied, except for Montgomery Ward Department Store. If you remember that, you know, I grew up in small town Kansas, and we had a Montgomery Ward, but Ward responded and said, hey, maybe we'll learn more. What became of that is they learned more and they showed how transformative credit scoring in a systematic way could be. And at that time, it wasn't very systematic. It was more a concept from a consulting perspective that could systematize something in that way. And then over the years, that became a truly systemized, automated, you know, tech-driven type of solution from an algorithm perspective that was standard using data from the repositories. And that created what we use today, which is, you know, what 90% of top lenders in the U.S., over 90% of top lenders in the U.S. use today to make the vast majority of credit risk decisions across all different types of lending products. So that would be personal loans, credit cards, auto loans, and mortgages. And so that's a little bit of history on FICO, who we are, how we came about. By the early 90s, the vast majority of lenders were using us for all of those different types of lines of lending decisions. And when we had those significant lenders using our solutions, that's when the GSEs noticed, hey, a bunch of people are using this thing called the FICO score, and maybe we should be using it too. And so then they came knocking, and then they opened up a competition. We won that competition. And that's when in the early 90s, the GSEs started using us as standard in mortgage as well. They've been using our score, which is colloquially referred to as FICO Classic, in the mortgage industry since then. FICO Classic is actually three different versions of scores associated with the three different credit repositories, 2, 4, and 5, depending on the repository. And that's the score that has been used, you know, for a couple of decades for FHFA, GSE assessment. From a tri-merge, to answer your question, so that's a lot of history about FICO. It's a kind of an interesting history I like to share with people because I think it's pretty interesting. And there's some confusion on how FICO came about and was used. I think people sometimes get the GSE use of the score reversed with it was already being used by lenders at a very high level before the GSEs adopted it. But from a tri-merge or bi-merge perspective, or, you know, there's even been a lot of noise the last couple of weeks about 1B, lots of blogs flying back and forth that I've been keeping an eye on associated with 1B. What I would say is I think we actually should shift the conversation to an even bigger risk for the ecosystem from a mortgage perspective, which would be what is being referred to as lender's choice. And candidly, I would say lender's choice is a really good way to brand something to make it sound better than it is. You mentioned I've been at FICO for over 20 years. I need to get them to strike that from my bio so I can seem younger. But I have been at FICO for over 20 years. And years ago, we had this marketing effort where we said, we need to name our products in a very descriptive way so people immediately understand what they are. And if you were to name Lender's Choice in a descriptive way so people immediately understand what it does from a risk perspective, you would rename it Adverse Score Selection. Because from a risk perspective, that's what Lender's Choice does. Lender's Choice sounds great. I get it. It sounds like you let the lenders choose. It creates competition in the market, and that will be great for all ecosystem participants. I get that, but that's not the reality of the situation with lender choice. The mortgage market's very different from other consumer credit markets in that with the GSE structure, we do pass risk to the American taxpayer. And with that, they've accepted a standard of credit risk assessment for all of the ecosystem players that need to care about that. So not just the originator of the mortgage, but insurers, investors, servicers, et cetera, rating agencies, all of those different users who need to understand from a standard perspective what risk looks like. Lender's choice, also known as adverse score selection, doesn't enable that because credit scores use different recipes. The FICO score recipe is not the same as the Vantage score recipe. They're not the same. They have the same ingredients, the credit reporting agency's data, but they are not the same recipe. So if I had milk, eggs, and sugar, I have the same ingredients, but I could be using that for a recipe which is going to get me a cake, or I could be using that for a recipe which is going to get me pudding. And the outcome of that is very different. The same is the case with the FICO score versus other score options that are out there. And before, you know, this is getting to be a long answer for you, but so before I end on this, what I'll just say is what adverse score selection actually does in the marketplace is it shifts what would have been a lower risk cohort to having more risk in it. Because of those two different recipes and the way that credit scores work, what will happen is people will always want to select the highest score that will provide a borrower the best price. And by the nature of the way credit scores work, what that will mean is you will actually always pick the best score. And there are a whole bunch of tools out there that enable consumers to understand where is their score the best across repositories or across different types of scores. And so what that means is more risk will be shifted in the same score cohorts across two different scores than you would have seen in a single score. And there are third-party entities who have studied this pretty extensively, and they've been able to quantify what the impact of that would be. One of the best ones that I've seen out there was done by Milliman, and they assessed that what we would see as a result of lender's choice is a 30% increase in defaults. And I was like, wow, that's a lot. But then I was speaking with somebody else in the risk space, and they told me they actually think that might even be understated from their analysis, and it could be closer to 50% increase in defaults from moving from a single score to two scores. And the last thing I'll say on this is it also could have potential impacts to GSE revenue. AEI, American Enterprise Institute, assessed that it could actually drive GSE revenue down by over $1 billion a year if they don't adjust LLPAs. And if they do adjust LLPAs, that'll drive consumer cost up from $350 to over $1,500 per mortgage. So this is really, really concerning, and not enough people are talking about that increase in risk systemically and the impacts of that. And so I want more people in the industry talking about those very real concerns with policy changes that could be made.
Yeah. Wow. I feel like I've learned, I've got lots of notes over here. That was amazing. Definitely a little concern there. You know, I think like there's a, you know, I think a lot of folks are really thinking about affordability for the borrower right now, right? That's a big concern for everyone. And, you know, I think to your point, Lender Choice is an exciting name, but there is like value to having like a single lingua franca of credit risk, right? That you could talk to, hey, you could talk to your loan officer and they understand what a 680 versus a 720 is. And, you know, the capital markets team at a lender understands that. And then an investor understands that. And the agencies understand that. So bringing in that extra choice, you know, while it could be helpful, I think it could also just obfuscate things like further for people. But building off that point, like FICO's been, to my point, like the lingua franca for credit like scoring. But, you know, the VantageScore 4.0 has been approved by FHFA and the agencies to be used. You know, you mentioned the ingredients, but do you mind like going a little bit deeper on like the cooking methodology there? Are they baking it differently? Is it at a different temperature, or are they putting it in the microwave and just putting it on 5 minutes? Like where, what's the difference there?
Well, thanks for asking that question. You know, and I can't, you know, with all transparency, I can say that when you think about the recipe for scores, right, there are general kind of components that make up that recipe. And those components, when you look at them, they also look the same, right? But the mix of those components is where we see differences. So some of the things that are the components in the recipe would be like, how much new credit do you have? How much are you utilizing the credit that you've been granted? What is the length of history that you have associated with credit on your account? So these are things that make up both recipes. But what you'll see when you look at the way that these scores are built is that the percent that you apply relative to the importance of that in the recipe differs pretty greatly. And so that'll differ in your outcome. The other thing that people don't generally understand about credit scores is we look at credit risk as a macro thing. So we can look at a probability of how much default we're going to have associated with the population related to what we believe the macro default will be. So like in the financial crisis, that macro level default greatly increased. But if you look at how the FICO score performed, we still perfectly rank ordered risk across the borrower population. It's just overall default rates significantly increased associated with decisions and risk appetites that were operated, you know, perhaps less than ideally during that time. And so not perhaps, certainly less than ideally during that time. And so, but the rank ordering of risk associated with that and the probability from, you know, 850 being the lowest down to 300 being the highest remained right on, even during the global financial crisis. And so we rank order that macro population along that range. And because our recipes are different, the way that we sort borrowers into each individual element in that range and the type of borrowers because of those recipe differences will be different. And so when you combine two of them together, you're not going to get a cake and you're not going to get a pudding. Who knows what you're going to get? But you're definitely going to get an increase in defaults because they're just not the same. They have the same objective outcome, but the way that they measure it is different. And so it's not like a metric to the American system, right? It's not like I could say, if I have a FICO score that's an 800 and I always subtract 20, I'm going to always get a competitive score. It doesn't work that way because there's not a single adjuster. And as macroeconomic risk change, the way they drift because of those differences in the component of the recipes will also differ. And so these are significant things that people need to understand about how credit score and risk assessment works to really understand the risk that this could introduce into the system.
Is the way to think about it then like more of like a bell curve effectively then, like in terms of like how, like I was thinking about more linearly, but I think it's more you know, bell curve is the only other adjective I could think of, but maybe it's more like scattershot or something like that. But
no, I mean, we definitely think about it. There's a higher probability. And in general, you know, you double the probability of risk as you move up 20 points or you move down 20 points, not up 20 points associated with the FICO score. And so it definitely rankors that population, but you'll have a swap set of borrowers based on those recipe differences. So if you're only using a single score in each of the single scores, you could get to the same objective outcome if you were actually managing your risk to those levels of risk on each of those single scores. But when you combine the two of them together, you'll swap in and out certain borrowers, and that's what pushes default up overall. And that's exactly what the Milliman analysis showed, is that that would push different types of borrowers into the highest highest scores, which are the lowest risk scores, and it'll increase default. So at a macro level, you'll have an increased default risk. If you separate it and you only use one, you can get to that single objective outcome, but there's no way to effectively do it across two. And that's, you know, that's just math. it's the way that it works.
Yeah, it's always going to skew to the more advantageous side for the lender. Yeah. And therefore you're going to kind of mix in the less creditworthy borrowers in a higher credit worthiness box. So you're going to get that sort of sneaky default risk.
Well, and the other thing is there's no way to control it. You know, there's questions about, well, could you always force that, you know, if you pull three, you can only present one. That's true. But, you know, one of the things I'm really proud that FICO was on the front end of doing over the last, you know, decade is making credit and credit scores visible to consumers. That has demystified credit to consumers. And that's been really important. I remember when I started working at FICO over 20 years ago, you'd go to an auto lender and they would tell you what your credit score was. And that's the only way you would know what your credit score was. That has significantly changed. And that's good. Consumers should be educated about what their credit score is. They should understand how to improve it. They should understand what's impacting it. They need to know that because some of the things that are impacting it may be data errors that need to be corrected. These are things that have been really improvements in the industry as a whole, and they've been good for consumers. But what that means is a consumer will know, is my FICO score better? Is my Vantage score better? Is my XYZ score better? Or is my score at TransUnion better, or at Experian, or at Equifax related to my FICO score? They'll know this because the tools are available to them for free to see that. And there's no way to control that in an ecosystem as vast and large with as many players as the mortgage ecosystem has.
Mm-hmm. Good point. So I think, you know, generally speaking, I think everyone would agree that competition is good, but there's a ton of nuances to that and a ton to consider, right? So we've talked about how there are, three different credit bureaus, right? And VantageScore is actually owned by the three credit bureaus, I believe. While FICO, obviously, as you said, Fair and Isaac started the business. It's always run independently. So there's a big difference there structurally. Like, how does that structural difference, do you think, impact transparency, pricing, competition ultimately for mortgage lenders? Does FICO have a view on that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we certainly have a view on this, right? And what I would first say is FICO also believes in competition, right? We've competed for our business. We compete every day in every consumer lending market and we win, right? We still have over 90% of all top lenders using the FICO score across all different types of lending decisions, irrespective of if the GSEs or the FHFA are involved, right? So we compete every day and we win because we have the most predictive standardized score in the marketplace. And that's what we compete on. And that's what we believe we should win on. So, you know, there was an analysis through the credit scoring initiative of the FICO score, and 10T by far and above outperforms the competitive score in the marketplace, right? We are able to detect 18% more defaults than the competitive score, which will provide a better risk prediction from a lending perspective. And so competition should be about in a lending space that has the unique dynamics of the conforming mortgage market, should be about managing stability and safeness associated with the mortgage ecosystem and picking the score that is the best risk prediction. We always have competed on that. We've always competed on building the best score, and we've always been happy to present our score against any other score because we know we'll win, and we've always won. And that is competition, and we believe in it, and we do it every day. Outside of the mortgage market, we win. Inside the mortgage market, we win because we have the best score. What is not competition is having a score that is owned by the three credit repositories with a requirement to get a report, which is what is used to derive the scores from those three credit repositories, and then scores, and then being able to select a score from either score provider, either one who is also owned by the three credit repositories who have no incentive to compete because all three credit reports are required, or a score that is provided and built by the only independent entity in this equation, which is FICO. The first Vantage score with the three credit repositories is vertical integration, and it will lead to no competition in the mortgage and credit scoring, in the mortgage credit scoring market. The second is an independent analytics provider with three credit repositories. It gets more complicated because for years, those credit repositories were the only distributor of our independent score. And so you may have heard of this little program we have called the Direct License Program, where we're trying to shake up that paradigm, and we're cutting out the three repositories in that Direct License Program model from being the distributor of our score. So last year, if you wanted to get a FICO score through a tri-merge reseller, the tri-merge reseller had to go to the three major repositories, Equifax, TransUnion, and Experian, to get their FICO score price. Now, those same tri-merge resellers, through the Direct License Program, have an option to buy that from us direct. And so that program is going to cut the repositories out as wholesalers of the FICO score and enable us to have an expanded distribution model to the mortgage industry. We're really excited about the traction we have. There have been multiple tri-merge resellers who've already announced that they've signed up to be distributors for us. Zactus and Cotality and Ascend Companies have all publicly announced that they're working through making scores available on our Direct License Program and have signed license agreements with us to do that. And there's many more behind the scenes that are working on integration with us as well. And so we're excited about the options that that will provide to the mortgage industry.
Yeah, I think kudos to y'all for that. Like, I think one of the things that's like one of the hidden weaknesses in the mortgage industry is just the amount of layers that are there, right? There's so many Russian nesting dolls scattered throughout the mortgage industry. And, you know, even in our world, the more the capital markets world, like the, you know, loans change hands so many times, and they get packaged into the bonds, and the bonds trade so many times, and derivatives of the bonds change so many times. It seems like there's a lot of overlap there. You know, you mentioned a couple of different variations of scores while we've been chatting, you know, FICO Classic, FICO 10T. You know, I've also seen in the news the Ultra FICO score. I'd love to hear your view on like how those scores are different. When's the right time to use one versus the other? And, you know, I think it just speaks to what you guys are doing from an innovation standpoint as well.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks for asking that question, Mike. So FICO Classic is our score that today is required by the GSEs. And that's a score that was built approximately 25 years ago. And FICO 10T is our latest iteration of kind of what would be considered our standardized U.S. credit risk model suite. And FICO 10T, the T stands for trended data. So one of the things you'll hear associated with kind of the credit scoring initiative and new modern credit scores being used is you'll hear that, oh, well, we can use, you know, rental data is used and trended data is used and this type of data is used. FICO 10T uses rental data. It uses trended data. That's, again, what the T stands for. Trended data looks at things like consolidation of debt. So it gives you a different view of the borrower's historic profile. So that's important and can prove risk prediction. Rental data, 10T uses. Previous versions of the FICO score used it too. Rental data is not new. We've been using rental data and FICO scores for over a decade. Unfortunately, of the 80 million renters in the U.S., only slightly over 3 million actually have their data reported to the credit repositories. So it's not quite the silver bullet anyone wants it to be. I hope it gets there. It's why we started including rental data in our product over 10 years ago. but it certainly isn't the be all end all solution. And there's a lot of work that needs to be done.
Julie,
to get that.
Is that just because it's like mom and pop landlords that aren't reporting like that data to the repositories?
That is certainly part of the problem, right? I mean, we've seen an increase, right? When I first started having my team track this, it was in the 1.7 range. So now we're over 3 million, right? So we're making progress, but of 80 million, 3 million is still just barely scratching the surface. And that's, you know, so that alone is not going to be an answer for people who haven't been using kind of more historic types of credit, like credit cards, or haven't gotten an auto loan, or those different types of products. So, you know, rental data alone probably is not going to solve that problem for some time. So that's where things like our UltraFICO model really come into play. So UltraFICO is our version of using cash flow data to help make a credit risk assessment. FICO was actually a pioneer in this space too. I believe we had the first standardized cash flow model available in the marketplace with our first introduction of UltraFICO. We have recently enhanced UltraFICO, and we announced a partnership with Plaid. They have over 12,000 financial institutions on their network. So we're going to use data that they're able to get from a cash flow perspective, and we're going to connect it with the repository data in our UltraFICO 2 and UltraFICO 3 suites. And the way that's different from other cash flow models that are out in the marketplace today is we use both sets of data. And when we build an UltraFICO model, you can have any sort of base FICO score from any of from Equifax, Experian, or TransUnion. And then we supplement that information with the cash flow data, and they're scaled on the FICO score scale range. And so you don't have to actually throw out all the work you've done in your underwriting process to provide this additional incremental information associated with a potential borrower. You can actually integrate this into the process that you already have, understanding the risk prediction and how that scales from a probability perspective. It'll really help people like thin file borrowers who haven't had a lot of access to credit. And the other thing we're doing is, you know, we continue and we're always looking at whatever data may be available in the marketplace to help us expand access to credit. We recently announced that we also have put out models that will look at BNPL data. So BNPL data, you know, also is not getting, there's also not as much furnishing to the credit repositories, but we have models that are available, and we've done extensive study with a firm and others to know that when lenders can start seeing BNPL data, they will have FICO scores that can consider that. And so that's another major innovation that we recently announced.
Yeah, the cash flow based approach is very interesting. I think it dovetails really nicely with just like what we've observed as like the rise of like non-QM and some non-traditional mortgages, maybe non-traditional, but non-agency, right? So, you know, for example, like, you know, we've seen, you know, DSCR loans as a percent share rise over the last two or so years. And you look at the economy, you think of, you know, the rise of gig working, you think of, you know, mom and pop landlords, Airbnb folks. It definitely seems like it's hitting at a time where you use that in partnership with, you know, some of these lenders who are focusing on non-QM. It could be really interesting for folks and help bring more, you know, credit and affordability to borrowers.
I couldn't agree with that more. I think, you know, you can get sharper with your pencil when you look at additional data sources. And that's why we took the approach that we did with UltraFICO. I sit on the Structured Finance Association board, and we just recently at one of our meetings had a whole presentation about what you just mentioned and, you know, talked through how we were seeing that shift. The other thing I would just say is, you know, from a non-QM perspective, we see people, you know, wanting to embrace additional data or modern things. And so we've seen incredible 10T traction with the non-QM space because it does use that trended data. It does use that rental data. So irrespective of any timelines related to the GSEs and the FHFA, we've seen incredible adoption of 10T. Right now, we have over $350 billion in originations of lenders who are covered by our 10T adoption program and $1.5 trillion in portfolio servicing volume. So we're really excited about that traction. And we think that just shows the opportunity for things like UltraFICO. People are seeing benefits in these spaces of using new data, using our best and greatest. And we look forward to serving them with UltraFICO too.
And that's a great segue into a question I've had for about the last 10 minutes, that, and maybe it's an obvious one, right? You've got FICO Classic, tried and true, models are built off of it for decades in terms of delinquency and performance on mortgage loans. But then we've got this seemingly exponential growth in different types of algorithms now. You know, you've got the 10T, you have Ultra FICO, you've got competitors out there now. Like, how should we, if I'm a lender, how should I think about making a decision on what algorithm or algorithms to use? And it may depend on loan program, like we just talked about, and the flexibility. But like, what are the main factors I should consider as a lender when I'm deciding which credit score mechanism I should be using?
Well, the first thing I think is important is that the consumer understands what you're using to make a decision, and you can explain it to them, because obviously there's regulations that require that. So it's really important that that's the first thing that anyone takes into account. I think the second thing then, as good stewards in the mortgage industry, it's important that you try to use something that can get the best terms for your borrower, but at the best risk prediction, so that you're not increasing risk into the ecosystem, right? And, you know, certainly we have plenty of studies that say that's 10T. And, you know, we look forward to more coming out to reconfirm what we've been saying for a long time. But I also think that, as in all different types of lending, there are scores that you use to be a language, like you said, a lingua franca, of this is what this is from a risk perspective, and I can share this with investors, and a rating agency can use this, and the insurer can understand what this is, and I can use this as an input to a decision that I'm making. But that doesn't preclude you from using other information from an underwriting perspective. And that's actually what we see, right? We see a lot of, you know, we see a lot of lenders that we work with across different types of consumer lending. They use their FICO score to help them explain things to the consumers in terms of approval, pricing, and even credit rejections. They help use the score to help consumers understand what they need to do to improve their probability of being able to get lending products. And then they also use other data to help them make underwriting decisions and to help them really sharpen the pencil. And so we think there's opportunity for all different types of data to help benefit the lending decision. But when it comes to making ecosystem risk visibility decisions, you can't have 25 different standards. It just doesn't work that way.
Good point. Well explained. And I think I like how you pointed out at the very beginning, making sure that borrowers understand how they're being evaluated. And I think you're doing a great job here, honestly. We have folks that listen to this podcast, I hope, that are not lenders, that are consumers. And I think just this has been educational for me and Mike, so I'm sure it is for them as well. So hopefully everybody's been taking notes. So thank you for walking through that.
Yeah. Yeah, I got a big list of notes over here, but Julia, to wrap us up here, you know, one of the things I think about in the strategy role is like the 3 to 5 year future for Optimal Blue, like what we're trying to work on. In your seat today, like, what can you give us any tips or hints on like what you guys are thinking about for the future? Like, what, you know, you guys have been releasing a lot of these different algorithms and, you know, trying to advance the ball here, but like, let's pretend we wake up in 3 to 5 years. Like, what do you think like the future kind of looks like?
Yeah, I would like to continue to drive consumer access to scores so that there's more visibility to that, to all types of scores. So really expand our programs to include things like Ultra FICO from a consumer perspective. We'd like to continue to advance that, right? We already do things like have programs available on myfico.com where you can get your FICO score for free. I encourage anyone to go out there and do that if you haven't already done it. So I want us to be continuing to do that, to be continuing to be good stewards of increasing financial inclusion, you know, by educating consumers on the credit ecosystem. So I hope we'll have continued to make significant strides in that, meaning that more people will understand what their FICO score is and we'll have made that even increasingly more accessible. I hope and fully expect lenders across all of the different types of product will be using FICO 10T as a standard by then, because it takes about 5 to 7 years for a new score to hit over 50% saturation. So I fully expect in your 5-year timeline, we'll be at that. I hope by that time, more people are looking at cash flow data with our Ultra FICO product. And I have about 6 or 7 other products of ways to look at risk from a scoring perspective, which are in the hopper, but I can't tell you yet because I can't be scooped on those things. But we've got a whole bunch of developments that we've been working on. I think we talked with you about one of them last year at a conference, but don't leak that, please, Mike. But yeah, we have a whole bunch of things in the hopper in terms of using algorithms to help people make better decisions about credit risk and other things as well.
That's fantastic. I think that's a wonderful forward-looking way to end the interview. Thank you so much, Julie. This has been, again, super informative for me and Mike, and I'm sure it will be for our listeners. We'd love to have you again on the podcast soon. And yeah, it's been an honor and a pleasure. Thank you very much, Julie.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a great time.
Okay, let's wrap this thing up. Big thanks to Alex, James, Mike, and a big Optimal Blue thank you to Julie May for joining us today. Such a great conversation and wisdom for us to take back to our teams to share. So that's it for today. Join us next week for another episode of Optimal Insights, where we'll continue to provide you with the latest market analysis and insights to help you stay ahead. Check out our full videos on YouTube. You can also find each episode on all major podcast platforms. Thanks again for tuning in to Optimal Insights.